This podcast was recorded live at 221 Beacon in Atlanta, Georgia.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard, they send you home. You feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Okay, so welcome to the Baker Street Babes live podcast at 221 Beacon. We are always honored to be here, and we are always honored to get to take part in 221 Beacon because it is a lovely, lovely thing.
They don't know anyone on the inside.
Dude, this is like a not radio joke.
I know.
That's why she made it on the live podcast and not the kind we do over Skype.
Radio joke.
Yes. Stage direction. Taylor takes off her director's badge and hides it under the table.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. There we go. Yeah. Well played. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Cue audience.
Nailed it. Okay.
We're good at this.
Yes. So,
would we like to talk about our guest for a moment, and then we will make him an honorary Baker Street babe?
Yes.
One of the few brave, proud. Yes. We are here today. We are so honored to have Martin Powell. He is the writer of hundreds of stories in numerous genres. He's written for names like Disney, Marvel, DC. He has been nominated for the Eisner Award, recently nominated for the Stanley Excelsior Award, and he's also a winner of the Moonbeam Golden Award for Best Children's Graphic Novel. And we would like to talk about the work that led to all of those things a little bit later. And we are so honored that he is with us. He is also a major Sherlockian, and that's why he's here at this con, and he fits with all of us nerds. So we appreciate him so much, and we would like to make him an honorary Baker Street babe. So we will ask him the questions.
How were you introduced to the canon?
By a nun.
This is a really good answer.
My fifth grade teacher. And it was during our reading class, and it was one of the stories in our reader, a Sherlock Holmes story, The Norwood Builder. Mm-hmm. And she started off by telling all of us, she said, okay, today we're going to read a detective story. And most people in the class are like, you know, and I was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. You know, and she said, it's a Sherlock Holmes story. And I didn't know who Sherlock Holmes was, but I'd heard the name, you know, enough to where it put an image in my head immediately. You know, so.
Yes.
And I was just, you know, 11 years old or something. And then she said, he's not just a detective. He was the great detective. And I was like,
that's right.
I was a little bit more intrigued. And then she said, he was so smart that he could just look at you and tell everything you've done today and he didn't have to know a thing about you.
Like a bartender.
And I remember from a nun. And she said that intrigued me. And so basically she had us read the story. And anyone familiar with the Norwood Builder knows that there's a very simple but very clever conclusion to that story. Mm-hmm. And that just completely, it was just perfect for the age I was. And I was impressed. I was kind of like, I recognized.
You were the right age to read it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was. And I recognized the simplicity of it and the cleverness at the same time, you know, which. I think if I'd been a little older, it might not have affected me as profoundly as it did. But it made me want to go to the library and find more Sherlock Holmes books. I had no idea there was so many.
Yeah. 60.
Yeah. And so that's basically how I started with Sherlock Holmes.
Great. And do you have a favorite case from the canon?
Of course, you know, your first love, they always say. So there's something special about that first story. Mm-hmm. I think that this is going to sound like a very cliche answer, but I think probably...
There is no cliche answer.
Probably Hound of the Baskervilles.
Sure.
Yep. Just in its sheer brooding intensity alone. It's maybe not the best mystery of the canon, but I think that...
But it's got devil hounds.
It does have devil hounds. Doesn't have much Sherlock Holmes, strangely enough.
But it has lots of Watson.
And it's
which is the most important character.
It's kind of like Dracula in a way. You know, when you read Dracula, and you realize he's hardly in the book.
Dracula is hardly in the book.
Yeah. But you get, and the same thing of Holmes. You get a Holmes in is through the whole book. Really, his influence is same thing as Dracula. You know, so it works the same way. I've actually adapted. It's the only Sherlock Holmes story that I've ever adapted into comics or graphic novels. Everything else I've done has been my own original stories. Mm-hmm. But I've done it twice, actually. I did it for a kid's book and also I was going to say mature reader's version for Dark Horse Comics, but really it's an all-ages version, you know, as opposed to the kid's version. Yes. I did. So, and I didn't just take the same script and go, okay, here you go again. I really actually rewrote it twice. So. So that's the one.
Do you have a favorite character in the canon? I mean,
wow.
And that's hard.
Aside from Holmes and Watson, you mean?
Well, no. You can say one of those, but
It's got to be Sherlock Holmes. Just for the mere fact that he terrifies me. And I have about 300 published credits. Only 9 of them are Sherlock Holmes stories. So he's very difficult for me to write. And always has been. It's so hard to write someone that's so much smarter than you are, you know, and make it seem believable. I used to have nightmares, actually, of meeting Sherlock Holmes. And nightmares. And he wasn't doing...
Where he would judge you? Where he would, like, look at you and...
Kind of, yeah.
That's what happens when your introduction to the character is a nun telling you, this person can tell everything you've done. Then you walk into him. Does he know? Does he know? I hope
yes.
He doesn't know. Oh, he knows.
You're right on target. He wasn't wearing a nun's habit, but you know.
He might as well. This is a very Catholic retelling.
Yes. I think that's whether he did it by choice or design, you know, accident, who knows? But Conan Doyle's character, I think, is a. It's something. It speaks to something in not just those of us here, but you know the mass population that don't know every little thing like a lot of us do, or at least some of the people in here do. I don't so much. But there's something. He's in us somewhere, you know, and maybe not even the best parts of us in some ways sometimes, you know.
Which leads us to, I think, the best question of the 4 questions is: who would you most like to have tea with? And that is not your favorite character. That is, who would you most like to have tea with and sit down and have a chat?
It could be your favorite character, but judging by the fact that you're terrified of your favorite character, probably isn't the
I'm
same.
Just feeling like psychologically go in any direction you want.
Irene Adler.
That was fast.
Yeah.
That was fast.
Now, I should emphasize the Irene Adler from the canon.
Yeah. So you mean the one who's married to Godfrey Dorton and saves him?
Yes, although, well...
You just ruined everything.
I'm sorry.
Yes, there would be something very intriguing, I think, about talking to a woman who outsmarted Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And I would like that's someone I would like to know.
So you can figure out how she does it, so we can stop haunting the streets.
Excellent. You are now an honorary Baker Street babe.
And I am honored. Thank you.
Well, and we are honored to have you, and we definitely want to move into talking about your work. I have with me the first run of Scarlet and Gaslight.
It's so pretty.
Which is beautiful. Obviously, this is not playing for our people by audio. Sorry. We will have a picture with the post.
And a link. Bye.
So please talk about how this graphic novel came to be and what it is.
It's a Sherlock Holmes Dracula story.
and there was much rejoicing.
It was one of the first things I did of any significance at all. I'd been published a bit here and there before, little anthology things, science fiction, horror stories, that kind of thing. It's the only thing of any length at the time that I had actually done, first thing. I wrote it primarily because this might not be a real popular thing to say here. It's hard to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I had read another book that was a Sherlock Holmes Dracula story that by a writer that I generally admire and still do, that didn't do it for me. And just as a fan.
This is not an unpopular
or uncommon.
And and then I read another Sherlock Holmes Dracula story, another book by another very well-respected author that I generally admire and still do, and didn't do it for me. And the main reason why both of them did not work for me, they're both well-written books. I didn't think that Holmes's reaction to the reality of Dracula was very realistic in terms of what Conan Doyle had
set up as the character.
Yes. No ghosts need apply.
Yeah. You know? Sussex vampire, yes.
So I felt, I remember sitting there just as a fan reading these and thinking, well, no. I mean, he wouldn't just suddenly think, well, let's sharpen the stakes and get the garlic and the crosses and let's go.
It's not a thing.
No. but I thought Watson would be more inclined to accept it with some evidence because, you know, in India, he probably saw some weird stuff and at least heard some strange stories, you know. So he's aware of the idea that such things might be there somewhere. But Sherlock Holmes, no, he would not have believed this, you know. But then I thought, but what if Sherlock Holmes was wrong? You know, what if vampires were real? What if Dracula is everything Bram Stoker said he was? You know, how would Holmes react when he faced him for the first time and Dracula changed into a bat and flew away? What would he think? You know, and I thought, well, he would crack up. You know, he would have a nervous breakdown because his mind would shut off. He couldn't accept it. Watson, on the other hand, would be like, wow, there are vampires.
Vampires, literally, right there.
So a good quarter of this story is actually Holmes completely out of it, you know, in his nightshirt, you know, being taken care of, nurtured by Watson, and Mycroft going like, I don't know, I think he's nuts, you know. And so that's the different approach that I took to it. But then using his own methods, Holmes figures out that, hey, these things are real, you know. And so I have him still, it's a heroic thing, I believe, that he, you know, he's out of his element, and yet, you know, is still.
And he finds a way to adapt.
Which is what he's always done. You know, I think that Holmes was out of his element the day he was born, you know. So,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, yes, I think that's fair.
So that's how I got started with this. It was something that I wrote it and I shipped it around to everybody in those days, all the publishers that I could find, and did it for 2 years. And usually I didn't even hear, you know, hell no. You know, I mean, I just got heard nothing, you know, crickets. And finally, sort of accidentally sent it to this particular publisher just as an example of me writing something longer so they could see I could do it. Because they were, I had something else, another pitch. I'd sent them something very different, and they, but well, how do we know you could write something this long? I thought, well, I've got a sample thing that I've done. If you want to see it, it's a Sherlock Holmes Dracula story. Oh, well, okay, send it. I did, and he called me back up and said he wanted to publish both. So that's how it happened.
It's already very high concept. I mean, you don't the elevator pitch is not long. So you're standing in the elevator and you're just like, I'm going to write Sherlock Holmes and Dracula, but the good way.
Well, I don't know how good it was, but it did all right. This was during what, in the comics industry, what was called the black and white glut, where there was all kinds of publishers that was popping up overnight, kind of like what self-publishing has become today, that everybody who basically had about $5,000 could publish a comic. And it was a wonderful time because it was almost like being in stock theater. You could learn your craft and get paid for it sometimes. I was lucky enough that I did. Not all the time. I knew some guys that didn't. But this was a medium-sized company for its day, and they treated me very well. And they even licensed the story with the Conan Doyle Estate, which they didn't have to do. Technically, I don't think they had to, but they did.
No, they didn't.
This was 1988.
They still didn't.
Yeah.
they still didn't, but people knew less that they didn't have to do that.
The publisher told me that he thought it was a gray area, but he felt that it was worth it to do it.
And that led to a really exciting encounter for you with someone very special.
It was.
You discussed that with
us. Yes, publisher called me up and he said, in about an hour, you're going to get a call from Lady Conan Doyle. And I was like,
that's
what? Well, we sent Scarlet and Gaslight to be authorized. I'm like, you what? You know, and so, and you know, she read it, and she's going to be telling, no, you know,
and so let Dame Jean read it. Yeah. Never show it to her.
So she did. She did call. I talked to her for almost an hour.
So cool.
And it was. I was just about 5 minutes of it was business, you know, and sort of like, well,
was the rest of it nerdy?
Did you hate it? You know, kind of. yes, I nerded out. Totally. First thing I asked her was, so did your dad like hate Sherlock Holmes or what? You know, and she assured me in her very proper voice that she just called him Papa. And she said, oh, no. Papa, he could not possibly have hated Sherlock Holmes. You see, Martin.
Sherlock, I'm chin-handsing right.
Sherlock Holmes was more than just books on a shelf in our house. You know, he prowled the corridors in his purple dressing gown, and he was my father, and he scowled at me, Sherlock Holmes did, across from the dinner table. You know, I was like, this is it. Was he dressed in a nun's hat? And she went on to explain that you know, she said, you know, he could not possibly have written 4 novels, 56 short stories, and hated the man. He just could not have done it. Couldn't have been done.
It's true.
Impossible. And I said, oh, okay, that's cool. So so she went on to tell me things like how James Barry would visit them, and you know, the author Peter Pan. He very good friends with Conan Doyle. And she said, it was just amazing to see Peter Pan and Sherlock Holmes in the same room together. and of course, but my favorite story of hers was actually the weekend visits they would have with Harry Houdini, who would come to visit. And she said, Harry would put me on his lap, and he would pluck endless American quarters from behind my ears.
American quarters. The real kind.
And I would put them in my various pockets that I had, and I was just heavy with them before he left. I don't know where he found all those quarters.
You got through all that in an hour phone call?
Yes.
That's amazing. Yes. That's the best phone call ever.
It was. My heart was just pounding. You know.
My favorite thing there, though, is the idea of Harry Houdini, who he's viewed as this, like, bigger than life name, and the escape artist literally just doing the dad quarter behind
him. Like nerdy dad.
Got your nose. Except it's Houdini, right? So it's your actual nose.
Nerdy dad.
Awesomely awesome. You also had a very illustrious mentor, and definitely we want to talk about that.
Oh my. It's hard for me to talk about this fellow without becoming a little emotional. Early on, when I was thinking about seriously being a writer, and not when I was in second grade, because that's when I wrote my first book, but it was the Winnie the Pooh book. I gave it to a nun, anyway.
I'm sensing a theme.
Yeah, it's one of those intervention kind of things, feels like, start to. When I was 19, I very seriously decided, okay, I'm going to be a writer, that's what I'm going to be. And even though I was mopping floors at Kmart at night, I was going to night school, I was in theater at the time, was also studying paleontology, so I was going all these different weird directions at once.
All the worst people are
studying. Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah, it's very strange.
Paleontology.
And you notice I was choosing all these careers where you can make a lot of money. I think I made the most mopping the floors. So I wrote a fan letter to Ray Bradbury, and I'm not sure why. I don't really remember exactly why I did it. I just did. And a friend of mine said, oh, yeah, I've got his address. I mean, it's like his home address if you want it. And I thought, is that rude? I mean, should I do that? I mean, it's Ray Bradbury. I mean, you know.
Should I bother him?
But I did. and sent him a little note, and I think it was about dandelion wine, actually, if I remember right. I think it was around that time of the year when I wrote it. About 2 weeks later, he surprised me by writing back, and it was a very nice letter, hand silver marker on a piece of typing paper. Just, you know, and it read the way I made that sound, you know. And it was very nice, and we just kind of sent cards to each other and things like that, Christmas cards, Halloween cards. His Halloween cards were great because he would just get like this generic kind of Halloween card.
I didn't know a Halloween card was a thing.
Yeah, well, he would.
I mean, if you're Ray Bradbury.
he would take like these stickers, like kids have, like little zombie stickers and things, and sticker all over them, and then send them to you, just Ray. Yeah. And one time he sent me one of his business cards, and it had his phone number on it. You know, I was like,
oh my God, I can call Ray Bradbury at any moment.
And it had written on the back, call me at noon. Oh. And I was like, what? So I was like,
is this noon your time, or is it?
And of course, this was a while back, so it was like, and he didn't answer. And so I rang. And I called back again at noon the next day. I did noon for 2 weeks. And finally, he, hello? Yeah. And I was like, may I speak to Mr. Bradbury? He's, well, my father's not here, but this is Ray. I said, Ray, this is Martin. Oh, Martin. Oh, that's all great. Great to hear from you. Great. I'm glad you called. Sorry, I've been, I was in England, actually. I flew for the first time. I was like, what? You know, he proceeded to tell me more about that later. He hated to fly. And this was right around when he was doing Ray Bradbury Theater. It was mostly shot in London. And his daughters had to get him kind of crocked to get him on the he didn't remember anything about it. He goes, you know, the Atlantic Ocean just went, and it was like, oh, we were there.
Don't think about it.
Rum and Coke.
It never happened.
Then he said, on the way back, I'll sit in there, I'll look next to me. I thought, you look like Bo Derek. It was Bo Derek.
So, early Bo Derek.
Yeah, it truly was. She's so nice.
Still, you look like Bo Derek.
Still my favorite Jane, he told me.
Is it an accident that you look like Bo Derek, or are you actually Bo Derek?
Or is it just rum and coke? You know? So I said, you know, what can I? I mean, I can't believe I'm asking Ray Bradbury. What can I do for you? A dumb 20-year-old, you know. And he's like, oh, I want you to send me one of your stories.
I said, oh, okay.
What? No. And I said, why? I said, they're just, it's because it's just awful. And he said, well, send me your least awful one. And I did. It took me a while to decide which one that was. And I did, and I sent it to him. And
it is a very difficult decision to figure out which is your least awful.
Yeah, and this gives you an idea, too, what people like us are like. We're insane. Because, you know, I proceeded to
100%
to send things out, and you know, for 5 years without getting anybody to even pat me on the head. You know, I mean, it just wasn't happening. And so you're setting yourself up for rejection and loneliness and all the kind of things that most people run from and hide from and try not to do. And you're doing that. That's not right. There's something very, very wrong with that.
You're actively doing it.
Yes. I mean, yes, and embracing it, kind of. And so he called me back about a week later, and he said, yes, I read your story, and I'm just, you know, ready to die, literally. And he said, okay.
This is not an auspicious beginning.
He said, it's much too long. And this was about a 600-word story I sent him.
But so, everything's too long.
That's exactly what he said. And he said, don't get discouraged. He goes, all stories are too long. Yeah. My stories are too long.
Right.
And he said, he says, let me give you the secret of the universe of writing. And I remember him saying that, the way he put it. And I said, okay. And I'm going to tell you exactly what he told me, and you make of it what you will, because I haven't been able to really decipher it yet. I'm still trying. I still don't know what I do. I have no clue. It just kind of happens. He said, when you start a story, start as close to the end as you possibly can.
This is the Alfred Hitchcock.
So there you go. That's the secret, according to Ray Bradbury. So he even told me that he, usually when he would write a novel, when he was done and decided, okay, it's done, he would take the first four chapters, throw them away. Yeah. He said, well, never even think about it, don't even look at it, just throw them away, because he said, no, that was necessary. It's like, wow, really? You know, is this really how this is done? You know, I guess it is if you're Ray Bradbury. You know, and I don't do it his way, but he would tell me how he got started working, and I'm only mentioning this because I know there's so many writers out there and who are doing it and want to. I didn't do it Ray's way, but maybe it will work for you.
I think that is actually like a very fair thing to say, though. Like, I don't do it Ray's way, but I took his advice and I ran with that, and it helped me, but I don't do it Ray's way. So, like, for instance, you know, I'm never going to write a Hemingway short story because I like adverbs. And I use them.
Me too.
So, like, that's never going to happen. But it is very fair to say that you admired this person's work. That was one of the reasons that you started writing in the first place. And then they said this piece of advice, and you're like, but I don't do it that way.
Yeah,
I don't do it that way because of the fact that I have a different voice.
Well, there's only one Ray Bradbury, but
There's only one Ernest Hemingway, and like I am going to use all the adverbs I can.
I mean, you kind of have to, no matter what, adapt any advice you're given to your personal style.
Yes. Well, the very drastic differences between us, to give you an example, is that I tend to write toward a conclusion. I know how it's going to end.
You know the hat trick.
And so I try to misdirect all the way through. It's from my old stage magician training in a way. It's kind of fiction to me is only successful if you're surprised frequently. You know, and so that's how I do it. That's not how Ray did it. What Ray would do is he would go down in his studio and he would sit there and he had all these toys and everything around, kind of like what I do. And he would look around and he would close his eyes and open them, and whatever he hit, you know, Godzilla toy, he'd go, oh, okay. He'd write a line, and then he'd get up, have breakfast, and go play with his cats.
This is almost identical to what Lee Child does. So every single time, the protagonist in these novels are...
Reacher.
Thank you, Reacher. Okay, every time Reacher goes to get a cup of coffee, it's because Lee got up and Lee went to get a cup of coffee. But that's all autobiographical. Every single time Jack Reacher gets up to get a cup of coffee, it's because Lee did that. And he was writing the book, and he was like, okay, I'm like bored or tired or like whatever, and I need a cup of coffee. So every single time Jack Reacher gets a cup of coffee, it's because Lee got up to get a cup of coffee.
That's awesome.
Yes. It is autobiographical.
That's awesome. So we communicated back and forth for a number of years, and he was always very patient and very understanding. We talked very little about work, if you want to call it that. He would be more likely to say, yeah, you have that part there, I didn't think that you can do better, you know, that kind of thing, and do this better like this, and oh, King Kong's on tonight. And that was really what Ray was like. You know, there's a Lon Chaney movie on tonight. That's really what he was more like. He was very, very, very much a film fan. He always recommended to me, and I always say this too because I think it helped me. You can follow it or not. It's up to you. But he always said that he didn't feel that he was, that many people were natural novelists, although there are some who are. My wife is one. I'm not. He always felt that the best thing to do was to write a short story a week. And he said, don't even worry about the quality at first. Just get it down. And then at the end of a year, you'll have, you know, 56 short stories. And he said, and it's impossible for all of them to be terrible.
That's not true.
Challenge. Highly optimistic.
They could all be true.
Mine were. So I have one less terrible than the others. That's what I said. So he would put it that way, and he would say that, and of course he would always say that, Ray, the way he would be. And then one day, just mystically, you're going to write something that's going to be wonderful. That still hasn't happened to me yet, but it may happen to you. He always, his story, The Lake, which some of you might be familiar with, that was the story that to him changed everything for him. Because he felt that he didn't become a writer until he wrote that particular story, and it was something that happened to him when he was a kid. His family was on vacation at a lake, and he was playing with a little girl that was there from another family. And he turned around one minute, and she was gone, and they never found her again. And he had forgotten that all these years, and he wrote the story. He said, "I was sort of typing away and tears streaming, and I didn't know why." And he said that was when Ray Bradbury, the writer, was really born at that moment. So that's something to kind of take away with you too.
Wow, that's powerful, definitely. And I want to ask you about some of your prose writing as well. I know that you do stories that cross Sherlock Holmes with another character that many people here are familiar with, which is Professor Challenger. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about those a little bit as well?
There was a publisher in Canada that was putting together an anthology of Sherlock Holmes crossover things, and for some reason they contacted me, and so the guy said, "Do you have any ideas?" And I said, "How about Sherlock Holmes in the Lost World," which is the title of the story, and it sold on the title, kind of like the Dracula thing.
It's high concept.
Yeah, and so I do have Challenger in one of my other Sherlock Holmes stories, A Case of Blind Fear, which has H.G. Wells' Invisible Man in it. So Challenger's in that too. I loved writing Challenger. Sherlock Holmes was a beast to write, but Challenger was just wonderful to write. He's just this gruff, obnoxious, but always right kind of guy.
He's a bit of a jerk, right?
Yeah, he is. And he's wonderful. I really loved writing him. And Conan Doyle apparently liked him better than Holmes as well. So I wrote the story, and with my paleontology background too, I early on had read The Lost World, which is still, I think, one of the best
things. I'm sorry, but not many people can be like, with my paleontology background. I just feel like you should lean your arm out, like, with my paleontology background. I just feel like this is not a joke for radio, but like, with my paleontology background, I'm like, yeah.
Well, in other words, I was a dinosaur fan when I was a little kid, and so I decided to
just describe to every paleontologist.
Yeah.
I like dinosaurs.
Okay, you get a degree in that. Congratulations.
It was always very disconcerting to me when I started working at museums too, that to find so many real paleontologists that hated dinosaurs.
Disappointing. This is like a paleontologist that hates trains. Like my little brother, it was dinosaurs and trains. Those were the two things. Trains, dinosaurs.
I mean, it's almost like they were jealous of them or something. Well, I like this little squirrel guy that lived in the Miocene. Dinosaurs are stupid.
He gets no love.
So that book made a big impact on me when I was probably about 12 years old, The Lost World. I remember getting it from the library. And
I think there's a lot of Sherlock Holmes fans here who are not really necessarily into Challenger. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Challenger, I'm surprised he didn't have them meet up himself, because they do seem to occupy the same universe when you're reading them. Mm-hmm. They seem to. I don't know that Conan Doyle would have thought of that in another way at the time. But something about Challenger, too, that's interesting is one of his, of Doyle's Challenger stories, The Land of Mists, actually has Challenger confronting the world of spiritualism, and he's converted in it, which Sherlock Holmes would have had a big problem with that. But Challenger, who is very materialistic and very much the scientist, mm-hmm. Doyle always said the Challenger was more brilliant than Holmes, in his own way.
Yes, but Doyle's the author.
Mm-hmm. So Doyle's wrong.
I mean, The reader has the experience at the end of the day.
That's true. So they, that I always thought that was interesting that he had, that Conan Doyle had Challenger converting to spiritualism, which of course he believed in, very strongly.
Yes. Fairies.
Do you feel that you've potentially been at, like, the crossover thing might be a gateway for people who are into Sherlock Holmes but aren't familiar with Challenger to get there? Have you ever had an experience where someone's come up to you and said, oh, because of you, I was into Sherlock Holmes, but now I found Challenger?
Well, not exactly that, but yes, the short answer, yes. Another one, I was at Chicago Comic Con one time back in the middle 90s, and this big gruff guy, bear of a guy, came up to me and he said, you write that Sherlock Holmes book? And I just kind of, yes. And I don't know. I mean, just, yes.
Maybe.
And he grabbed me by the front of my shirt.
You're like, do I look like Nicholas Meyer?
I wish I was Nicholas Meyer.
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
We're very happy that you're you.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very sweet.
We're very happy.
Wish I could write like he does. But so anyway, he picked me up and slammed me against the wall. And he said, you ruined Sherlock Holmes for me. You had to meet those Martian guys and all this stuff. And I went, I didn't write that book.
Do I look like Nicholas Meyer?
I guess he was talking about the Manly Wade Wellman book. I'm not sure.
He was talking about Sherlock Holmes' War of the Worlds.
Yeah, but
You're definitely not a Manly Wade.
I guess I convinced him I wasn't the guy. And so he let me down, and he kind of like grumbled off, like, oh, I'll find him. He's here somewhere.
This is a man on a mission.
Yeah. I was going around that.
He had one job.
That was the first really hostile fan that I ever encountered. You know, this guy was really offended.
What year was that?
It was probably about 94, I think.
What, you know the guy?
No, I'm trying to figure out if Wellman had passed away by then or not.
Yeah. I couldn't. Well, he was on his way out, one way or the other.
It may have still been alive at that convention.
Too soon.
But he was
too soon.
Once
two more years. Two more years of
this. He's hiding. Good job.
My fault. He had been dead since 1986.
Oh. So he missed
his chance.
6 years old.
I was going to say Lindsay might want to assault the writer of Sherlock Holmes or the Anyway.
Yeah. So a number of your books are for children, including your Hound of the Baskervilles. Could you talk about how you initially started with that as something you're interested in and how that has carried on into really beautiful books, a number of them?
They do look very nice. I have nothing to do with how they look, so I can brag on how they look. I wanted to write kids' books for a number of years, and it was a really tough market to get into, really tough. And it didn't matter what I had done, you know, or what I, you know, pretend to do. They didn't care. It seemed to be a very closed kind of situation. Finally,
the market is very specific.
It is.
Quite targeted.
It is. Stone Arch Books were the ones that published this. They contacted me out of the blue one day. I almost thought it was a joke. And in fact, I did think
all
it was a joke.
All the best things are started as a joke.
My name's Michael Dahl. I'm the creative director for Stone Arch Books. I thought, sure you are. And he said that, you know, that they were aware of the Sherlock Holmes books that I've written. And again, I've written a whole lot more than just Sherlock Holmes, but that seems to be, you know, what... Oh, Holmes always pops up in my life when I seem to need him.
Good. Isn't that the way?
It's really strange.
Yes. Paint it the truth.
And this was a situation where I had been working at a museum. I'd worked for Disney for a while, wrote for them, and then they sucked my soul and I never wanted to write again. And so I took 5 years off and just did not want to have a single creative thought for 5 years.
Proprietary, and then it belongs to Disney, and then let's never
talk
about Disney.
Yeah, sorry. Exactly. I understand it's a little bit better now, but back then it was horrible.
No, it's work for hire.
So I went back to work with Dinosaur Bones and so forth, and that was fun. But the itch started to get to me eventually, too. It starts again, you know. And that was actually sort of the beginning of Sherlock Holmes and the Lost World was kind of coming to me then. But he said, we would like to do, we're doing a series of children's classic books as graphic novels, and we'd like you to do Hound of the Baskervilles. And I went, oh, Sherlock Holmes again? And I remember just going, why does, you know, why Holmes? Why, you know, started sounding like Moriarty, you know. And Holmes to the always, you know, Holmes the Scotland Yard jacket office, you know. So I just, of course, told him I'd be delighted, you know, and which was the smart answer.
It would be my pleasure.
And I did. And I was familiar enough with The Hound of the Baskervilles that I didn't even open the book to adapt it. I just wrote the script and sent it off. And the editor and I had a little bit of cross swords a couple times.
Was there a way that you felt like specifically it should be adapted for children, though? Like, for a specific age group? Was there a way in which you approached it and you thought, these are the most resonant things?
They were telling me that they wanted it for fourth graders. Mm-hmm. Whatever that means. The thing, yes, let me answer your question. The first thing I suggested to them was to make Holmes and Watson younger.
Sure.
Than people depict. And because most everybody sees them as middle-aged, and they just, in the actual stories, they just weren't. You know, I mean, when Holmes and Watson met, I think Holmes was, what, like 26 or something like that? Watson, 28? I mean, they were...
26. He's 26.
So, but the public.
Watson is 28.
Yeah, but the public doesn't see them that way. They see them. Most actors who have played Sherlock Holmes have been in their 50s, and he had already retired by then.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just.
Jeremy Brett, for instance, even when he, you know, began the Granada series, which is very verbatim and fantastic, but Jeremy Brett was 50.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it just, I think it has something to do with the way the public perceives that kind of, that sort of intelligence that you need some, it looks, the individual, it's kind of like James Bond doesn't really work for me if he's too young. He needs to have the experience on his face that we know that he's lived and he's done this stuff.
You've done
and
shit.
It's, yeah. It's the same thing for Sherlock Holmes. And I'm not saying that, a younger Sherlock Holmes wouldn't work. I think it could, but in movies, generally, they don't seem to go that way. I felt that Holmes and Watson needed to look young in my, you know, the best films, because they were. Not because I was writing it for kids, necessarily, but I did think it would possibly make them more attractive to the kids reading it.
But it was still true. Because
it was, yeah. Right? And the guy kind of argued with me a little bit about that, saying, "Oh, but they weren't." I said, "But they were."
But they were.
And so they so that's one thing. I was determined to not write down to kids. I kind of was leaving it up to the editors to decide if they felt I was going too far. So I kind of wrote it the way I wanted to write it. I did keep it in mind that I was writing to kids, but it's still pretty much the story. I mean, I didn't really simplify it or anything. It's still got a very nasty villain in it, a kind of horrifying plan that he has. I changed it slightly at the end. Most everybody here is familiar with it, I'm sure, the actual book and the various movies. I felt that I needed to conclude it because I felt that the way Conan Doyle leaves it is Stapleton's out there in the moors.
It's
and
a little bit ambiguous.
You believe they're going to get him, but we don't really actually see that happen.
Well, you think theoretically he drowns. But.
Yeah, and I show that he does drown. And the difference that I thought, and this is the way I portrayed it for the kids, is Holmes is out there with his lantern going through the moors looking for him, and he hears him call to him, and Stapleton's stuck in the bog, and he's going down, and Holmes, you know, kind of looks at him, and that kind of judge kind of thing, and then...
In his nun's habit.
Yeah.
Vox Populi, Vox Day.
And
he pulled his lantern, he puts on his wimple, and he...
That gave me a shiver for a moment. But anyway. But Holmes actually reaches down to grab him, to help him.
Because Holmes would do that.
And he and he's pulling him out, and he's saying, you know, look, I can't hold on to you. You're going to have to. And then they slip, and he goes under. And Holmes just stands there and kind of watches him. That's all he can do. So I wanted to show the kids that he tries to save him, you know.
He would try.
Yeah, I think he would. Even though, you know, in that particular story, Holmes does mention that Stapleton was the most dangerous man that he had ever encountered. Of course, he hadn't encountered Moriarty yet, chronologically.
You have to backtrack that.
Yeah. But I enjoyed doing it very much, more than I thought I would. Nice returning to Holmes again. And it turned out to be a beautiful book. I have it in my table if anybody wants to come over and look at it. It's a beautiful looking book. It's a Spanish artist that basically painted it And it's gorgeous.
It's very pretty.
Yeah. And you've gone on to do how many more children's? Many more.
About 30.
Less, And these, I love, this is not going to play well on audio, but this is one of the educational ones, and it has like a glossary of terms for young readers, which I absolutely love. I think if you're an educator, librarian, these are fantastic and very strong characters, lovely female characters, really nice.
I tend to write toward females more than males. Always have. When I wrote Scarlet and Gaslight, there's two major female characters in the story, Lucy Westenra, which I flesh out a lot more than she is in Stoker's book, and also Sarah Bernhardt, the actress, is a character in the book. I didn't realize at the time until I was at my first convention, which was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. It was at the university there. First convention ever as a fan or a pro. It was my first one ever. I didn't know what to expect. I came to a room like this, and besides two guys, all women. And I was like, wow, that's actually kind of cool.
And hey, ladies. Yeah.
That was nice, my bachelor days.
Paleontology.
Sorry.
I'm a paleontologist. It's like, I'm a paleontologist. Did you know? And then he leaned like this. Paleontologist. How many paleontologists do you know? She quietly pulls down her
So it was very nice. I found that early on I had a female readership, largely. And that's mostly just because mostly women read. I mean, it's true.
I always find this a very interesting question because I have had gentlemen say to me, you know, I only read nonfiction. Like, it's a thing. Like, I only read nonfiction, but that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you write fiction. And I'm like, yeah. Okay, so you only read nonfiction because if that's what you like, then great. But if you're only reading nonfiction because you feel like that's more of a baller move, it's not working.
And congratulations, you might live in 1840.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Not in a good way.
Not in a good way.
Not in a good way.
Before we wrap, what are you working on now? What's going on lately?
Yes, what's next?
Oh my. Well, I keep pretty busy on a weekly basis. I write a series of 11 different weekly comic strips for Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated, the people who own the Tarzan license and so
good,
forth.
Good.
John Carter of Mars, that kind of thing.
So you're writing fan fiction a lot.
It's, you know, one of the things that Ray and I first talked about was he said the first book that he ever wrote was when he was 12 years old, and he wrote a sequel to the first John Carter novel, Princess of Mars.
Perfect.
Wrote it on his toy typewriter, so a little dial typewriter, because he couldn't afford the other one, the real one, so he wrote his own. So that's what way it works. So that's what mostly keeps me busy. I'm also writing the occasional kids book, and I'm starting to get back into writing my own prose novels again. I have a horror novel that's in the works right now. That's for grown-ups. So I don't think it would totally kill a 12-year-old to read it. But so that's about what I'm working on now.
Further questions? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I have a two-parter.
Sure.
Manly Wade Wellman is awesome.
Is this a question or a statement?
It's a statement and a question. Manly Wade Wellman is awesome. Not
yep.
that novel. War of the Worlds.
I agree.
That novel is really
I
bad.
Agree.
But Who Fears the Devil or The Old God's Waking, he should have more readers. Based on your, drawing from your paleo-theatrical background, what would you suggest as the one to read
that.
First for a reader who was interested in Professor Challenger but had not read any of them yet?
It's a good question. Lost World.
Lost World.
Yeah. There's one that I like a great deal too, The Poison Belt, but it reads better if you've read Lost World
you
first because there's some of the same characters.
You can't read Poison Belt second. You have
yeah,
to read
right. yeah.
Lost World.
But yeah, it's a wonderful story. It would be a great stage play, I've always felt, The Poison Belt.
Yes.
It would be.
Play out really well.
Yeah.
Have you written for the stage lately?
I have. I'm actually in the process of doing The Color from Space, the Lovecraft thing, as a stage play.
Well, yeah. That's going to be
great.
Awesome.
It's supposed to be produced in the Twin Cities up north. Lovecraft on stage.
I wish we had time for lots and lots of questions, but I think that wraps our time up. It's been absolutely delightful talking with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Being with you later.
And I'm so glad I didn't wear my nun's habit, because that would have been it would have been really awkward.
So am I.
For an awkward moment.
I thought about it too, and I was like, maybe not today.
No, she tried it on.
I did. I tried it on, and Lindsay took one look, and she was like, it's a little much.
I was like, it's too much.
It's too much.
Too much. Yeah.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. If this whole damn world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1
Are you interested in sponsoring an episode of the Baker Street Babes podcast? Please get in touch by emailing info@bakerstreetbabes.com or tweeting at us @BakerSTBabes. Thanks.